curtain has descended across the country.
Today, our very freedom came under attack.
If young people do not see hope, what kind of message are we sending?
Welcome to the podcast. My name is Colin McEwen, and we are about to talk to a diplomat. Our special guest today is a fourth-year undergrad student for the University of Toronto in European Studies and History. He writes for our program here at the Atlantic Council of Canada, A View from Ukraine, and is one of our newest junior research fellows. If you haven't seen his writings yet on our website, please check it out. His first one was about the multifaceted value of visa liberalization. Now that's a mouthful. Anyway, Matt Korda, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
So you were in Tbilisi, Georgia this past reading week, I seem to recall. And as a student, I can tell you reading week is a rare gift not to be squandered lightly. So what was so tempting to trade away?
Pause. So I went with a class that I was taking about politics and the European Union and its applicants. And I went with a bunch of fellow students and my professor, Dr. Robert Austin. And so it was this really amazing chance to learn a lot about a country's history and politics and learn a new language, which I attempted to do, but this Georgian is really difficult. And it was an incredible opportunity to meet representatives of NGOs and representatives of the government. And Georgia is actually a really inspiring country for young diplomats because it's the political force there is actually extremely young. The prime minister is, I believe, he's 32.
Wow.
It's the second youngest head of state after Kim Jong-un.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe that's not something to be proud of.
No. But, yeah, so it's really interesting because we got to speak to people who were really making a name for themselves in politics and were only 10 or so years older than myself.
Wow.
Which was really nice. So, yeah. And it was also really interesting to be able to conduct primary field research.
Right.
So it's really... It's not something you get to do often if your field is European and Russian politics and history and you live in Canada.
Right.
Yeah, and so it's you really get to learn the value of meeting people firsthand and getting your information from those specific sources because as I was doing my research before I left, there were a lot of facts that or statistics that are very easily misrepresented, especially in that area of the world where that type of thing tends to happen sometimes. And so I went there and occasionally quoted a statistic and then someone would say, actually, that's false. That's the opposition telling you that that is this, and it's really hard to know who to believe sometimes.
Well, hey, meeting people firsthand is what this show is all about. So thank you for that. Now, when you agreed to come here, you mentioned that you had a large host of anecdotes. So spill the beans.
Yeah.
Tell the story.
I can talk to you about the taxis in Georgia,
oh.
Which is it's quite the force. Essentially, it has large economic issues. The economy is really going downhill, and the unemployment rate is actually quite high. I believe it's around 14%.
Wow.
It's about double what Canada has right now, and even that statistic is often misrepresented because. The Georgian statistics industry kind of, they count hand-to-mouth farmers as self-employed workers. And so there really is this kind of extreme economic disparity when those people are actually quite poor.
Right.
And aren't essentially employed, but they count as employed. So the unemployment rate is actually quite higher than 14%. And so as a result, you have all these people from outside Tbilisi looking for money, and the easiest way to do that is to buy a sign that says taxi, essentially attach it to your car in some fashion, and then drive into the city and pick people up and drive them places. The problem is a lot of them are from outside the city and they don't know the city very well. So pretty much every other taxi that you get in will drop you off at the wrong place. And so all of us there were... And they all drive really, really fast as well because they're trying to get to their next... They're trying to get a large turnover rate. So they're just kind of careening around corners, dropping you off in the middle of highways. And there was a time where we were trying to get to this really well-known theater. And we got into a taxi, and he then dropped us off on the side of a highway. We got into another one who took us to Old Tbilisi, which is across the river. And then finally we got into a third one who took us where we wanted to go. But it was...
It would be a comedy if it weren't for the fact that these people are desperately poor.
Yeah.
One anecdote, I guess, from my side. A few days ago at the time of recording, at least, former President Mikhail Saakashvili shocked us all by taking up the post as governor of the Odessa Oblast.
Yes.
Now, I did not see this coming at all.
No.
Like, what even happened?
It seems... Essentially, because I think it was a surprise for everyone, I mean, including many Georgians, especially since he was offered the post of I believe it was vice president, and he turned it down. And now he's taking this post as governor of Odessa, which is a smaller position, but still important. And it's really interesting to see how... Essentially, like there's a kind of a host of Georgians that are moving into Ukraine. There's another, I believe he's a former deputy to the prime minister, or like someone who's right. In quite a high position, has also taken a large position in Ukraine. It
almost seems like it's deliberately, you know, giving the finger to Russia. Like, hey, you remember this guy? Well, he's on our side.
Well, it's also giving the finger to Georgia in a way, because a lot of Georgians are really upset. Because he's wanted on many charges, including money laundering, believe embezzlement. And so he's now taken this position in Ukraine and essentially given up his Georgian citizenship. And so it's seen kind of as this big insult.
All right, so in your bio on our website, you describe yourself as, quote, an aspiring Kremlinologist. Now, that's a word I've never seen before. Can you unpack this a bit? What is it about the Kremlin in particular, as opposed to Russia as a whole, that merits its own ology?
Well, aside from just giving myself a pompous title for fun, but it actually does refer to something pretty specific, and it refers to closed societies. So it essentially, this can be said for Russia or somewhere like North Korea, where you don't really have access to the behind-the-scenes political moves like you can elsewhere in transparent societies or in transparent governments. So in Russia, in particular, you really have to analyze the different clues that members of the Russian government, like Vladimir Putin or any of his associates, things like that. So you can analyze vocabulary or statements that they're making, or it could even come down to who they're tagging in their Instagram posts. Like, it shows who they're hanging out with, who they are conversing with, and it matters because that's the stuff that's public to us. And so in the article that I'm writing this week, I'm going to be talking about how essentially the plan, the Novorossiya campaign that was supposed to unite...
Fallen apart.
Yeah, it's essentially fallen apart. The word is gone. The word has essentially dropped out of the political vocabulary. And it kind of shows that the project is just not... It's dead in the water. And it doesn't look like it's being resurrected anytime soon. So you can assume from that they're kind of moving to a plan B, which I would expect is just stagnating Ukraine to the point of, you know, paralysis.
It's curious that you mentioned this information, because sometimes what it seems is not so much that there's a war of information, you know, between Russia and the Ukrainian separatists and Kyiv and, to a lesser extent, Brussels, but a war on information, where, you know, there was the OSCE finding... Once upon a time, there was a fact-finding mission from the OSCE, and they never made it. They were turned away as soon as they got there. So, like, what can a country do, like, say, what can the Canadian government, the U.S. government, the German government, what have you, when in Russian civil society the very mention of these is fraught with, you know, the tinge of maybe not treason, but, you know, betrayal, or even Western civil society groups, involving them, somehow it seems less likely to succeed. What could the West do to try and beat back this crush of information?
It's an interesting question. It's also a very difficult one to answer, precisely to the point that it's very difficult to do anything if you are a Western government. It's difficult to essentially mobilize Russian citizens, because they are essentially they are also being fed this war of information, or war on information, as you put it. But they're being fed propaganda, and whether or not it's believed, it's the kind of thing where that's the information that's going into the system. All the news is controlled by the Kremlin. Everything is controlled. All the media, all the major media sites and blogs or television stations or people that speak out are removed. And so it's, you have the Nemtsov murder a few months ago, the prosecutions of Navalny, and it's very difficult for Western governments to kind of get information into Russia. As to what we can do, to be honest, I'm not certain, but...
At least you admit you don't know. Most talking heads on TV would rather die than admit they didn't know something.
I would hope that there's something behind the scenes going on that we just don't know about. Potentially there's... I know the Hmong School has projects in which they are able to converse or receive or send information to dissidents in Iran. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's something in the works for Russia. I would hope so.
The Citizen Lab is secretly engaged in a revolution. So I'm glad you mentioned Ukraine, because that is, after all, what you write about for us. So put it this way, since Ukraine is, you know, sort of ongoing, there are often disagreements. For example, when I went to talk to the students, some were saying we should be doing more, we should be outright supplying them weapons. Hmm. Some say it's not our problem. What I didn't hear was, I guess, what you might call the real politic argument, a reputation for being a bit cold-blooded. But suppose someone were to say to you that Canada and NATO, broadly speaking, should stay the course when it comes to Ukraine, to keep doing what we're doing, that between the economic sanctions by the EU and various businesses leaving Russia, capital flight has, you know, topped $150 billion in 2014, and it's on track to go well past another $100 billion this year. So Russia's, you know, bleeding money, and because of the pressure on Ukraine, the country is, you know, consolidating. It's consolidating a national identity. They're reforming their government, reforming their army. So suppose someone were to make this case to you that we should let this stand, because if we push too hard, Russia might stop, and then they wouldn't be paying these costs. Hmm. Is that too cold-blooded to you? Like, what's your instinctual response?
Well, the more and more that I look at the situation as it develops, the more I see the ball being in Russia's court at the moment, and it looks like they have their own agenda with how they want this to play out. And so, essentially, the way that I can see the varying solutions, or not solutions, but I suppose the end games of the issue that we have right now, is that in a full-out invasion, does not seem to be the plan A anymore, if it ever was. It just seems like it would cost too much money, and at this point, the cities that Vladimir Putin believed that he would be able to turn to the separatist side don't seem to be cooperating. Cities like Odessa and Kharkiv. And so it seems that a full-out invasion is just not likely. And it seems like now his approach is essentially to Bosniafy Ukraine. And so what I mean by that is essentially these two self-proclaimed separatist republics, Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, essentially Russia doesn't have to return control of the border, the Ukraine-Russia border, via the terms of the Minsk agreement. They don't have to return the border unless Ukraine agrees to give these two republics essentially constitutional reform and their own autonomy rights, which doesn't seem likely, because essentially it would be creating this puppet Russian empire within Ukraine, and it could essentially just stagnate the country. So what I think is more likely to happen is the frozen conflict option, like what is going on in Georgia right now with Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and And essentially we could be seeing essentially those two regions staying put with Russian troops controlling the border for however long. I don't see a full-on invasion as a prospect anymore. Even though there are reports right now, I'm hearing within the past few days, like a big military buildup along the border. People are saying, like, oh, a summer offensive might happen. I'm not convinced. I think it's more of a bluster than anything else. Maybe saying, like, give these republics their constitutional authority or else.
Well, if that happens by the time this episode is uploaded, we'll both look rather silly.
Yes.
But such is the way of things, I'm afraid. So I asked this question of all of our younger guests, and we've only had a few so far, but there will be more. So 5 years from now, it's 2020. Who knows what else is happening, but what are you going to be doing?
I'm not sure. Hopefully finishing up some form of grad school degree. Potentially law school. I'm not certain. Hopefully definitely continuing more work in this field.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you very much for your time.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. Check out our website, natocouncil.ca, for previous episodes, as well as ongoing coverage of events every single day. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn, all of which can be found from our homepage. Next week, our special guest will be giving us the most in-depth view of Syria you've ever heard. Talk to a Diplomat, signing off.